Hello, everyone. This is Kristen Jesterson with the Tamarisk Coalition. We're still having some people log on, so we'll get started momentarily. In the meantime, I will have our presenters go ahead and mute themselves. And if I could get a confirmation from one or two of you that you can hear me by typing into the chat box, that would be great. Okay, I've got my confirmation. Great. Okay, we'll get started. Looks like we have a number of people on the call here already. Again, I am Kristen Jesterson with the Tamarisk Coalition. You are participating in the 8th installation of our funding webinar series. Today we're going to be talking about funding for restoration in Arizona. Thank you for calling in. We're going to start by talking about a couple of the web conferencing ground rules. All of the participants will be muted during the presentation, so we cannot hear you. But we will be taking questions at the very end after all of the presentations have concluded. So you will have an opportunity to ask questions. If you have questions that come up during the course of the presentations, I recommend that you write those down. And if you could specify which presenter you'd like to ask that question of, that helps as well. If you're experiencing any problems or technical difficulties, you can type those into the chat box to the left of the screen. Everyone has access to that. Many of you have already done this, but if you haven't so far, it would be great if you could sign in by writing your full name and the organization that you're with as the sort of in lieu sign-in sheet that helps us get a sense for who's on the call. Also, it's helpful for you to mute your computers. If you are calling in and just listening through the computer, we recommend that you call in as well as log on to the website so that you can ask questions at the end, because those cannot be asked through the website. When you do speak and ask questions at the end of the presentation, we ask that you mention your name and affiliation. And the way that you will do this, and I'll remind you of this at the appropriate time, but to ask questions, you can press star 1. And you will be put in a queue, and those questions can be asked in the order that they are requested. And we have an online evaluation form, and I will provide you with this login or this website info towards the end of the webinar. But you can, and we request that you please fill out the evaluation form so that we have a better sense for what's working, what's not working, and if you found the webinar valuable. All right. So a little bit about the Tamarisk Coalition. I'm sure some of you are familiar with our organization, but for those of you who are not, we are a nonprofit organization, and we are headquartered in Grand Junction, Colorado, but we work throughout the southwestern U.S. To help advance the restoration of riparian lands through collaboration, education, and technical assistance. We do this in a number of ways. We help partnerships that are working on the ground to create restoration plans. We help actually engage in restoration activities. We host conferences on up-to-date research and land management techniques. We help establish native plant materials programs. We monitor Tamarisk biological control agents, such as the Tamarisk leaf beetle, and provide information to folks who are doing this work throughout the southwestern U.S. And we help to identify and coordinate funding opportunities for partnerships during this work. Someone has asked a question as to whether there will be access to the PowerPoints and so forth. Yes, all of the PowerPoints presented today, as well as an audio recording of this event, will be made available on our website in about a week. And I will send out any updates about that information, but our website is www.tamariscoalition.org. So that information will be accessible in about a week's time. All right, to sort of kick off today's theme, I wanted to give you a quick overview of some funding opportunities that are available through the Arizona Forestry Department, because our representative from that department was not available to participate today. There are two main grants that have relevance to restoration work, and the first is the Community Challenge Grant. This grant program supports citizen involvement in long-term and sustainable urban and community forestry programs. So if you have a project that has some relevance to improving the long-term health and care of urban forests or urban forestry projects, this is a good resource. Local and tribal governments, nonprofit organizations, and public education institutions are eligible to apply. There wasn't available, the RFP date, or the next RFP date wasn't available, but the website is provided here, and if you did a quick Google search, I'm sure you could find this on your own. But again, these slides will be available, so you can find this information on our website at a later time. The second grant that they offer is the Wildland Fire Hazardous Fuels Grant. And this grant helps support the reduction of hazardous fuel materials. These priority projects are on lands that are adjacent to national forest and BLM lands in Arizona, and those that are identified at risk of wildland fires. Fire departments, local governments, educational institutions, and nonprofit organizations are eligible to apply. And according to the website, the RFP should be out in late fall. The website is attached here, and the contact from the Arizona Forestry Department is Elise Rogstad, and her email is attached here. Other resources for funding available to organizations and partnerships doing restoration work in Arizona and beyond can be found at the Arizona Invasive Species Advisory Council's website, as well as the Tamarisk Coalition's Riparian Restoration Connection website. The Riparian Restoration Connection website is a website that the Tamarisk Coalition maintains, and there are a wide array of resources, both national and local, available on that website. And the link is riparianrestorationconnection.com. With regard to future webinars, we are hoping to host a future webinar focused on landscape conservation cooperatives. The date for that has not been scheduled yet. We also want to host a website or webinar that is focused on joint ventures, which are good mechanisms for accessing North American Wetlands Conservation Act funds. And we hope to organize a webinar focused on the common pitfalls of fundraising. So that's it for me. You can feel free to send me any suggestions about webinar subjects that you think might be relevant to your work or to the work of others by emailing me at kjesperson@tamariskcoalition.org. All righty. So I'm going to pull up our first presenter's presentation, and then I will introduce him, and we can get this started. Just a moment here. Okay, our first presentation will be done by Rodney Held, who is the Executive Director of the Arizona Water Protection Fund. He's been with this program for 15 years. Rodney has also held the position of Community Water Planning Manager, Deputy Assistant Director, and Assistant Director for Statewide Water Planning Resources at the Arizona Department of Water Resources. So he has obviously a long career in this subject, and is an expert, and we look forward to hearing about this program. Rodney, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Go ahead.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you, Kristen. Got out of advances. There we go. Appreciate your inviting me to be here today, and I know some people on the call have been to my grant workshop, so a lot of this information will be kind of a repeat, so I apologize for that, but I'll try to get through it as quickly as possible. The Arizona Water Protection Fund is a competitive state grant program, and we provide funding for the restoration, enhancement, and maintenance of river streams and associated riparian habitats. And then our statute also allows us to provide funding for projects that develop or protect riparian habitats that are associated with human-made water resource projects, but they have to directly or indirectly benefit a river or stream and include or create riparian habitat. So those are dealing with the man-made projects. Why is this advancing? Did I go too far? Sorry, I'm having technical difficulty. Just a little bit of background about the program. We were established in 1994 by the Arizona legislature, and this in part was a proactive response to potential federal intervention that was related to construction of the Central Arizona Project. The legislature also wanted to promote using incentives instead of regulation to address our resource concerns. And so as such, our commission's philosophy has been to really utilize a grassroots approach, which allows the public to propose local solutions versus the state dictating those measures, priorities, or areas of concern. The program is overseen, as I mentioned, by the Water Protection Fund Commission. They are the main policy-making body for the program. They are politically appointed by the governor, the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate. There's also an Intertribal Council of Arizona representative, and then a representative appointed by the Central Arizona Water Conservation District. In total, we're supposed to have 15 members. I currently have 5. This program is overseen and administered through the Department of Water Resources. We provide the technical, administrative, and legal staff for the program. The State Land Department historically had a position, and that person was really intended to work with natural conservation districts to assist landowners with developing proposals for consideration by our commission. Unfortunately, because of funding issues, we have, from funding issues, we have had to keep that position vacant since 2000. And then our funding for the program, historically we had the ability to receive up to a $5 million general fund appropriation, and that was taken away from us in the fiscal year 2012 legislative session. So now we're completely dependent on in-lieu fees, which are generated from a tax collected by Central Arizona Project. That's basically a tax on excess water they sell outside of their Tri-County service area. Not a real stable funding source, as you can probably imagine, given the water shortages that we're dealing with here in the state. And then we're also allowed to collect gifts, grants, or donations. Oh, heck, I keep thinking I'm doing a PowerPoint and clicking in the wrong spot. Sorry. Some considerations for fiscal year 2014. We have about $1 million available to put towards projects this year. That's money that we've collected, just banked over the past 3 years from money we've collected through CAP. Approximately $151,000 will be available for research. Other consideration, and I mentioned the commission in this last legislative session, the legislature changed the makeup representation of our commission, so it's going to be down to 9. 5 of those positions will be related to natural resource conservation districts. Representing natural resource conservation districts. So it's going to change the background quite a bit and make it a lot more rural-centric. And then some new requirements that came out in the last legislative session, federal agencies will no longer be eligible to receive funding from our program. That doesn't mean we can't do work on federal land. It just means that federal entities cannot apply for the grant or receive funding through our program. And then we had some changes in our research requirements and evaluation criteria back in fiscal year 2011, and so that's still going to be new considering that we haven't had a grant cycle since then, so just something to keep in mind. Projects that we fund, we have 3 categories. Our main one is capital projects. That's where we put most of our money, and these are going to be on-the-ground projects such as fencing, revegetation, channel stabilization, etc. Under that category, we can also provide funding for acquisition of Central Arizona Project water or effluent in order to restore hydrologic conditions. And then we also have what's called a feasibility of design study, which is kind of like research, but in order to be eligible under that category, you have to actually be requesting funds to investigate the feasibility of implementing a specific capital project that you want to propose. And as part of that, you have to develop a detailed implementation plan and budget, and then you also have to be the entity with control and tenure over the land so that you would be able to implement that project if it's deemed feasible. So the second category is research and data collection. As part of that, you have to demonstrate the use of the scientific method. Keep in mind that that category, we're limited to 5% of the total amount of funding we receive in a fiscal year. And so, again, I mentioned we'll have about 151,000 available. The third category is water conservation projects. Those projects have to be outside of our active management areas. There's five in the state. The reason for that is they have their own conservation augmentation programs. And we are limited in that category to funding a total of 5% of whatever we award in a year. So that means we have to award the capital and research projects first. Let's see if I can get this. So to date, the commission has invested in 199 projects around the state and contributed almost $43 million towards restoration in Arizona. And the map, I don't know how well you can see it on your screen. It blows up nicely on a PowerPoint, but all the little dots on that map represent projects that the Water Protection Fund has provided money towards, and hopefully you can see that we funded projects in every county of the state. And there's just a list, I won't read the list, but you can read that for yourself, of the types of projects that we have funded. And through those projects, Arizona citizens have realized a lot of benefits, including improvements in water quality, in-stream flow and water supply, biodiversity, fish and wildlife habitat, recreation, flood control, overall watershed health, and then the socioeconomic benefits related to the funding that we're putting into local communities through implementation of our projects. So eligibility for the program, basically any person, organization, as I mentioned, non-federal agency or tribal entity can apply for a grant. The project must be located within the state of Arizona. And your primary goal really needs to be the enhancement, maintenance, or restoration of river streams and riparian habitats. It's important to demonstrate that in your application. Excuse me. Ineligible projects. So projects that are designed to meet minimum wastewater treatment requirements. However, projects that are designed to create or sustain riparian habitat using treated effluent or recycled water that meets or exceeds relevant state and federal standards may be considered for funding. Projects located in areas with elevated levels of environmental contaminants. These would be contaminants that pose risk of harm to human health or the environment. It could be petroleum contaminants, those kind of things, but anything on the EPA priority pollutant list. Projects that are required as a result of legal action taken by a regulatory agency. These are such things as ecological mitigation. So if you did something wrong and you're being required to do it, you can't ask for us to pay for it. The purchase of real property, unfortunately, that includes conservation easements and water rights. That's a statutory requirement. Groundwater recharge is typically not funded just due to the overall cost. Passive recharge is okay if you're doing some kind of wetland projects, those kind of things. And then again, I already mentioned the projects that are outside the state of Arizona. Some important considerations. The applicant has to have legal access and authority to manage the area where the grant tasks are to be performed. We do require that you provide documentation of land ownership. You can get written, if you're not the landowner, if you can get written permission from them supportive of the project. You will be required to develop cooperative agreements for, and as part of the application process, if you can get a letter of support with a plan to obtain that agreement, you'll meet the requirement at that point. Also, you have to have physical and legal availability of the water, and it has to be for the proposed purpose. So just because you have a well on a property, you may be restricted to the use of that well. You might not be able to use it for a restoration project. Or if you're trying to divert flows for establishing revegetation efforts, you have to make sure you have the water right to do that. And we do require that you provide the existing water right documentation with the application. Paying staff positions. One of the reasons why federal entities are no longer eligible for funding is the legislature was upset that we were paying federal staff to do work on federal land. The intent for staff positions are if you're an entity that lives off of grants, if you're a nonprofit, or if you're hiring temporary or seasonal staff, it's okay, but make sure you're not double dipping by asking for us to pay for staffing needs that are already funded through another source. Keep in mind that administrative or what's termed overhead costs, we are limited in statute to a max of 5%. Also, we cannot reimburse for any expenditures that are incurred prior to having an executed contract, and that means the contract signed by you and our commission chair. Another very important consideration is that we're a reimbursable program, and that means that you have to expend the funds up front and do the work, and then you provide documentation to us that that work's been completed along with a payment request. So you have to be able to have some backup funding, and a lot of times matching funds come in handy for that. We do allow for a one-time advance request. It can be up to 20% of the total, or it can be 20% of the total amount you request, but it cannot exceed $50,000. Sometimes that can get your project jump started, so we do allow that. And let's see. As far as our grant cycle schedule goes, we've already completed the workshops. This webinar, kind of the timing was pretty good. Thank you, Kristen. I will be offering pre-application consultations as far as my availability goes, and that just means that if you want to develop a draft application and submit it for feedback, you can do that. We can either have a one-on-one conference, do it over the phone or in person. I need the application at least a week in advance to do that. The final date and time to submit an application is August 28th, no later than 3 p.m., and we're very strict about the deadline. We don't accept anything that comes in after 3. We are required by statute to have a 45-day public comment period, so all applications are posted on our website and available for review. And then we do offer the opportunity for grantees to provide a presentation to our commission. You'd have 10 minutes, and that's your opportunity to sell the project. So we highly recommend that you take advantage of that. We plan on awarding grants in December, and that will all be determined by whether or not I have a commission in place by that time, since everything's going to be changing in September. So keep your fingers crossed. Just quickly with our evaluation criteria, we kind of look at things in a primary, secondary source based on our statute. The primary is, does the project enhance, restore, maintain riparian habitat? Those can be things like protecting and restoring the habitat, restoring hydrologic conditions, restoring stream geomorphology, channel characteristics, floodplains, and wetlands and backwater areas. And I should mention that capital and water conservation projects are evaluated differently than research, so we have that going on. With the fish and wildlife that are dependent on resources, that's really our secondary area of concern. And so are you protecting the habitat needs or restoring those, decreasing the impacts of non-native species, protecting and restoring resources to benefit either state-listed or threatened and endangered species or species of special concern. We do look at the feasibility, just quickly, whether your objectives are clear, your methodologies are appropriate, did you define a good scope of work, how we look at the expertise of the applicant and your personnel you'll be working on there. Also required by statute that if there's any existing plans, could be watershed plans, TMDL things, anything like that, that those are provided with your application, and you identify the relationship to your project. We look at your monitoring objectives and methods to make sure they're clearly presented and appropriate. And then other considerations that we look at are, do you have broad-based public involvement or support? Although matching funds are not required in our program, our statute indicates that we need to give priority to projects that do have matching funds. Public outreach, the commission really wants to see a public outreach component. It could be site visits, you know, public forum where you're having people out on the site. Could be developing signage, submitting information to a publication, whatever. And then they also want to see that they're supportive of local businesses. And if you're using out-of-state consultants because we've had some significant cost differences in that, they want to see a justification for that use. Excuse me. With respect to the research evaluation criteria, we are looking to make sure that it's applicable to advancing the science of stream restoration in the Southwest. Also, we're looking at, are you advancing the scientific understanding of fluvial processes, ecosystem characteristics, functions in association with river streams and wetlands, those types of things. Also, will you advance the scientific understanding of the vulnerability or potential impacts to riparian areas from climate change? That could be another area we would be looking at. Or evaluating impacts or values of invasive species in riparian habitat. Again, let's see. We are looking to make sure that the scientific method is being demonstrated, looking at your background research, data collection analysis, those kind of things. You have to either be building on existing data or generating new data. We're prohibited from statute from funding duplicate research. Also, we look to see if your hypothesis or hypotheses are clearly articulated, and then if your research or experimental design is appropriately designed to test those hypotheses, analyze the data, and report the results. Where am I? Feasibility is going to be similar to what we already talked about with the Capital Water Conservation. Commission wants to see that these results would be transferable. They're not just going to be static for this project. Would they be applicable to advancing other efforts that have gone on? They also want to see that there is a commitment to doing some type of publication, whether it's a scientific journal, a watershed newsletter, something like that, and also a public presentation, which could be at a watershed meeting, a water protection fund, a scientific presentation, et cetera. And then they also have these final criteria, the same as what we already talked about as well for as capital and conservation. So just to keep in mind, our contracts are based on the application. The better they're written, the easier it is for us to do the contract. And we really, it's important to pre-plan on how the project should be structured, what the components and permits should be, when the components can be completed in a realistic timeline, who the necessary personnel are to complete the work, and how much each component will cost to complete. Some of this other stuff, the signature on your cover page and the SHPO form has to be somebody who's authorized to bind you in a legal contract, and we do require that you submit one electronic copy and 4 hard copies. So I'm not going to go through the application contents. Just keep in mind that our manual on pages 9 and 10 have a complete outline of all of the information that we require. We don't have specific forms as some other grant programs do. We do have 4 electronic forms just to try to ease providing that information, such as the cover page. There's a watershed map, an environmental contaminant and location map, and then also the SHPO form. And those are set up so you can tab through and type the information. When you go, if you apply for a grant, please make sure you go through the manual and really look at those requirements. Everything is outlined for what has to come in, and then starting on the next page, there is a description for each of those requirements. one thing to keep in mind when you develop your scope of work for our program, basically the first 2 tasks are usually going to be related to permitting and planning. We do pay for permits, so if you have to go through NEPA process or you need to get your SHPO taken care of, you can build that cost into your first task. Some programs don't allow that, so just want to make sure that's clear. Plans, we require that you submit your monitoring plans, your restoration plans, public outreach plans as the second piece, and then all the additional tasks are going to be implementation of those. We do require that there's a final report as your very last task, and just in case you're not sure what deliverables are, those are projects that you submit to us to identify that you've completed the work. And every task should be set up this way with the number, the title, description, the purpose and objective, what you're planning on submitting to us for a deliverable, the due date, and your cost. We do also require that you provide a detailed budget breakdown, and all expenditures for every task must be itemized in that breakdown, and it's broken down by the direct labor, outside services, other direct costs, capital outlay and equipment, and administrative costs, and those are all described in the manual as well if you're not sure what those expenditures stand for. Just some common problems that we've noted over the years is that a lot of people don't fully develop the project. They just submit concepts, and that makes it really difficult for us to evaluate the validity of the proposal. And so we highly recommend that you try to go through those pre-app meetings. The physical and legal availability of water, we've had numerous projects come in where people really thought they had a right to use the water in a certain manner, and they really didn't when it came down to investigating the water rights. So make sure you check into that. The administrative costs, again, we're very strict about that. You cannot exceed 5% of the total cost you're requesting from us. That does not, it's not the same requirement for matching funds. Project management, please make sure you have somebody who's a strong project manager who can coordinate the project, keep in contact with Water Protection Fund with any issues. Oftentimes we can help overcome those. Being inconsistent with our program goals, make sure you're looking at the evaluation criteria. Again, I mentioned we're a reimbursable program, and just this week I've had several people contacting me freaking out on how they're going to pay for some things because they don't have the sufficient cash flow to cover it up front. Commitment of other partners, we recommend that you get that in writing. researching the necessary permits you need is key. In the manual under task, we have an example for task one, and there's a whole list of just some examples. It's a pretty good starting point. And then your timelines, make sure you're being realistic, especially when you're talking about the amount of time that it's going to take to get your permit. So just some common problems that we've noted over the years. And if you need additional information about the program, our website information is here. That's the address where applications will be submitted. That's the main line. If you have any questions, you can contact me at any time, or if you want to set up a pre-app meeting. So that's my presentation, and I guess we're going to take questions at the end. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Rodney. It's great to hear that this program has been rejuvenated, so I'm sure we'll have some questions. We're going to pull up the next presentation, and then I will introduce our presenter, who is Marty Herrera. He is the Heritage Fund Administrator for the Arizona Game and Fish Department. In this role, he oversees the Heritage Grants Program for the department and coordinates the Heritage Public Advisory Committee for the department. He has been with the Arizona Game and Fish Department for about 8 years. Rodney, you would mute yourself, and Marty, you would unmute. Let's see if you can. We can hear you. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay, great. Yes, absolutely. Go ahead and take it away.
The only thing, I don't have visibility of the slides. Oh, there they go. Okay, I'm good to go. Good morning. Thank you, Kristen. This morning, I will be providing an overview of our department's Heritage Fund, how it supports wildlife conservation efforts throughout Arizona. I'm also going to detail our Heritage Grants Program available to the public and how to apply for award opportunities related to wildlife conservation. Our granting program is competitive as well. I'll be talking about just a historical context of the Heritage Fund, the grants program, and there again, how to apply for a Heritage grant. The Heritage Fund was established in 1990 by the citizens of Arizona, and the department currently, we manage about 800 species of fish and wildlife throughout the state, to include threatened and endangered species. And the fund is one of our critical funding sources for the department, encompasses about 14% of our overall budget, and it benefits communities statewide and supports programs that improve quality of life in Arizona. Since 1990, we receive $10 million annually. With this funding, historically, we employ about 65 employees statewide in all of our six regions, primarily tied to wildlife conservation efforts for the money that we receive. In 1992, the commission established our Heritage Fund Grants Program. And so it's been in place since then. We only had 1 year in 2011 where we didn't award any grants, but the other 22 years we have. Since inception, the department has awarded 740 Heritage grants statewide, totaling almost $15 million. This slide represents just a snapshot of the last 8 years of the amount of heritage grants that we've awarded. But I just wanted to show the overall value that's included when you also include matching dollars that our grant applicants bring to the table as well. So the last 7 years, we've awarded $3.2 million, but the overall value is over $7 million. Just an example of two programs or grants, successful grants that were awarded in 2012. The one for the town of Clarkdale, it was submitted as a public access heritage grant. However, it did have components where they wanted to restore riparian areas along the Verde River. We have six funding subcategories established within our Heritage Grants Program. There are environmental education, outdoor education, schoolyard habitats. Those three probably won't apply to the audience that we're looking at here. Those are primarily for public schools throughout Arizona. But the last three, urban wildlife, public access, and IAPM, which is the identification, inventory, acquisition, protection, and management of sensitive habitats, those three primarily will apply to applicants that might be interested. And I'll cover the last three in detail. The other three I'll just briefly. This is a breakout of our current grant cycle where we received 73 applications. We awarded 32 heritage grants, right at 44% success rate for the applicants that applied. If you look at IAPM, we had $200,000 available, but we only awarded 103, almost 104,000. Three of the applications that we received didn't meet the priorities that we were looking for, so I think there's some opportunities there for the 2014 grant cycle. For our 2014 grant cycle, which is currently open, we opened it last week. We have $432,000 available and designated within each of the subcategories as noted. Our application deadline is September 30th, 5 o'clock p.m. We also adhere to a pretty strict deadline schedule, so please make sure that if you're interested, have your applications to us by 5 o'clock September 30th. Eligible applicants include federal government, tribal, state, local governments throughout Arizona. Although the majority of the applications or the proposals that we receive are for work in Arizona, they have to be tied to wildlife that's in Arizona. We have had a few projects that have encompassed New Mexico, Utah, as well as Arizona, but the wildlife have to be native to Arizona. We have had a few applicants that have applied, non-government organizations or private organizations, but they have to be sponsored by an eligible applicant. And if they do get a sponsor, the sponsor is the one that takes the responsibility for the project in accordance with the grant agreement. And they're the ones that will administer the fund for the money that's awarded to them. So they will have that responsibility. Our application process, one of two ways. You can either mail it in, where we require one original, two copies, or we'll accept electronic copies or submittals. And all we need is just the electronic submittal. We do ask that if you do submit electronically that you call and make sure that we received your application. Fax copies will not be accepted. Again, our deadline, September 30th. We do have a four-page application that's on our website for five of the six categories, EE, Schoolyard, Urban, Access, and IPAM. For OE applicants, we do have just a one-page application form that requires a field trip itinerary. And all of that information you can find on our website. Has our Heritage Grant manual, our application forms, the funding windows for all six of our funding categories, and any information that you need in order to apply for a Heritage Grant. We do pre-screen the applications that we receive. For these five subcategories, the two screening criteria that we use must be an eligible applicant, and their proposal must meet one or more of the goals, objectives, or priorities listed within the respective funding window for which the grant proposal is submitted. And then, an authorized signature, somebody that's responsible for or has the authority to sign for a contract within the organization. For OE applications, like I said, it's a one-page form, must be submitted by an eligible applicant, authorized signature. Funds for OE can only be used for transportation costs and or substitute teacher fees, and then a field trip itinerary included within the application. We've pretty much refined our entire heritage granting process to make it as simple as possible for applicants to apply. The last 2 years, we've received 171 applications, and we've only screened out one application in that time. So the instructions, the guidance is pretty easy for prospective applicants to apply. For those applications that don't meet the initial pre-screening, we will contact them, and they will not be considered any further for a Heritage Grant within that grant cycle. But we will tell them why they were screened out. The proposals that meet the pre-screening will transition to the review and scoring process that we have in place. The funding windows is probably the most essential component of our grant process. We refine these every year. Our program leads take a look at these, and they'll update the goals, objectives, and priorities of what they're looking for the coming grant cycle. And in order for proposals to be considered, they must meet one or more of the goals, objectives, or priorities. Those that are proposals that we've received in the past that meet more than one stand a better chance, but all they need to meet a proposal is just the one goal. This ensures that we award the most relevant proposals with the limited funds that we do have available. We have scoring teams that are established every year for each of the six subcategories, and these are comprised of 2 to 3 technical experts from the department and then 1 or 2 of our Heritage Public Advisory Committee members, and I'll get into the next slide on who those individuals are. And you can find information on the scoring teams, what the evaluation criteria that we are going to be using on pages 13 and 14 of our grants manual. So this way applicants can go and they'll be able to see ahead of time what we're looking for. Our HPAC committee is a volunteer committee just established to improve communication between our commission, the department, and the public. They come from representing the entire state. We have 2 committee members from each of our 6 regions, 2 statewide members, 1 national member, and then 1 of our commissioners serves as the chair of the committee. The committee meets 2 to 3 times a year, and they are involved with a whole gamut of things that are going on throughout the department. They also participate in the grant scoring process. Each proposal is reviewed, scored based on its own merit as a standalone application. We do not compare the applications against each other. Each is evaluated against our established evaluation criteria and assigned a score by each scoring member. At the end, we average and compile these scores internally. We place these highest to lowest within a rank order list based on final average scores received. And then we go through a review, discussion, and approval process of all six of our rank order lists with our department's executive staff. And then finally, the lists are approved by our director. All the funding lists, depending on the amount that we have available within each subcategory, will go down to where we've exhausted the amount available, and that'll be our funding line that we depict. And we'll make contact with all above the fund line applicants for them to submit additional documents that are required if applicable. A lot of cases, SHPO, EIS, MAPS, other supporting documents that are required, they'll have a 60-day window to submit the additional documents. The reason we do it this way is we wanted to make it as simple as possible, as easy as possible for applicants to submit their proposal without having to go through all this if they weren't going to be awarded a Heritage grant. So this way, they know they're above the funding line, and as long as they provide additional documents that we require, then they'll be awarded a grant at the end of that time. We have had a situation where above-the-line applicants, for whatever reason, have not been able to meet, and if that's the case, then we go below the line and we'll, again, in rank order, and we'll notify those individuals and let them know that they are not being considered, and we'll just work it until we are able to provide the awards for all of those above the line. We also notify all below the fund line applicants just to let them know that they weren't successful this cycle, but encourage them to apply during the for the next cycle. Just the same, we have streamlined it in such a way where we make these grants available as early as January of 2014. Now, the reason we did this, a lot of the teachers, students involved with our OE grants that are involved in the planning, we wanted to ensure that they would also be the ones that took part in the actual field trip activities. We felt this was important rather than them planning for a follow-on class the next year. So this way, schools can take part in our granting process and be able to have the students involved during one school year. Environmental education, I won't touch much on this. There again, it's primarily for public schools throughout Arizona. Same thing with OE. The schoolyard habitat, I'll touch on this a little bit because it does involve habitats and restoration of habitats throughout the state. We did have one located up in Flagstaff, that a past application that was submitted by one of the junior highs there, and they submitted their proposal to restore the pond that was adjacent to their school, Francis Shore Pond, and they received a Heritage grant for $10,000 for that project. The junior high has since closed and moved on, but this is just an example of habitat, schoolyard habitats that might be available. This has been probably one of our most successful components to our granted process, the schoolyard habitats, because of the long-term effect that we have and just our ability for the department to be in the limelight for schools and students, and not only the ones that are involved in the actual construction of the project, but for classes on a long-term basis for sustainment of the habitats, and just becoming knowledgeable with the Heritage Fund and what it stands for statewide. We probably have over 100 habitats that have been constructed statewide at public schools. Just examples of some of the components for schoolyard habitats. We do require that students be involved in all parts of the process, from the planning, construction, the post completion of the habitats. And just, I provided contacts for our subcategories. You can contact any of the contacts at any time if you have any questions, and they can provide information to anybody that's interested in any of our subcategories. Urban wildlife, this one, guidelines that we've established. The project must be within an incorporated city or town or within 5 miles of the boundary. And there, I think there's some opportunities for restoration of riparian habitats through urban. Just some of the goals that we are looking at, and a lot of it has to do with how an applicant puts their proposal together. In being successful on getting an award granted. Just some examples of previous projects that have been awarded. One thing to keep in mind, like some of the goals like wildlife viewing, there's definitely some opportunity for an applicant to have this as a component of their proposal, but in addition to restoring riparian habitats that they're also interested in, and a lot of it, like I said, has to do with how they put their proposal together. Just some ideas that people might be interested in. Outreach is also important to the department, and the majority of the projects in the past that have been successful have partnered with community organizations. And it just really goes a long way to enhance their proposals. And just an idea of some of the partners that they've linked up with. Or if there's an NGO that wants to apply, and just some ideas of who they might link up with to partner with them and submit an application on their behalf. Robin Beck is the contact for Urban. Her information is there. Public access, another opportunity for heritage grants. There again, just like the one successful project that I cited for the town of Camp Verde, it was submitted as a public access heritage grant request, but the majority of what they were trying to do was associated with restoration of riparian. They have like 2.2 miles of the Verde River that they were wanting to conduct work on. Just other examples. We do ask that projects consider including enhanced accommodations for persons with disabilities anytime they're looking at public access, which is important. Al-Iden handles public access for land, and Eric Swanson for waterways throughout Arizona. IFM, this is the one area that I think provides the most opportunity for restoration of riparian habitats and some of the work that the coalition is working towards. This funding window is broken down into three different priorities that the department has established, and each priority lists several species of wildlife that they're looking to work, have the projects work towards. In terms of detail, the proposal, anybody interested in the proposal would benefit if it identified species, specific waterways where tamarisk removal would occur. And in talking with our research branch, they cited the Little Colorado River near Winslow and the Colorado River upstream of Lake Havasu as two sites where such a project would benefit several native fish species, as an example. And these that I'm showing are just examples of some of the Priority 1 projects that they're looking towards. There again, anybody who submits an application within this subcategory, the best success would be to tie it to some of the wildlife species that the department is looking towards enhancing. So definitely if they put their proposal together in those terms, probably have pretty good success. This is the main contact for IFM. But I do want to give one other additional department contact from our research branch, Andy McInster. His phone number is 623-236-7675. And he would be the one to contact if anybody's interested in this subcategory to try to discuss any proposals that they're looking at. Funds must be requested within 12 months of the effective date. So the date that the grant agreement is signed by the applicant and our director starts the clock. And we do allow applicants to request up to 90% of the grant award up front and the other 10% at the end of the – when they close out the project. Grant projects must be completed within 36 months of the effective date. And there again, the applicants must have control and tenure of the land or waters in which capital improvements are made. The grants manual has all the information that's needed as well as the forms. This is the timeline that we're looking at. So from the time that we receive the applications to the time that we they have the end of their 60 days on additional documents, we're looking at about March 1st of when we will know who's getting awards for heritage grants. All of our applications must include a budget worksheet, detailed item, line item breakout of all personnel costs, development costs, and other costs. Although match is not required, it's highly encouraged because it is a competitive process, and those proposals that do identify match are normally the ones that are the most successful in getting awarded. Just an idea of some of the personnel costs. We do utilize wage rates that are listed as examples in the website that's available to gain this information. Covers pretty much any type of position that you can think of. Pre-existing costs, we won't cover those, but they can include any of those as part of their match costs. We also will not approve any requests for funds to supplant or replace personal costs that are already being paid to employees within an organization. They can use those as match, though. These are all eligible expenses, travel, supplies, equipment. Only restriction is for environmental education, limited to 5% of the funds requested. Grant reporting, we do require mid-year reports and end-of-year reports throughout the 3 years of the grant cycle, and then a final closeout report that's due to the department at the end of the project. And we do have limited monitoring requirements for completed projects, where we select at random up to 10% of the projects completed within any given year. Normally, we'll go out to one or two sites and just do a follow-up site inspection to ensure compliance with the project proposal that they had submitted. Contacts for myself and Robin Beck for the Heritage Grants Program. And that's all I have, Kristen. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Marty. That was a very thorough overview of the program, and there's a lot of information in there. We are running a little bit over schedule here, so I'm going to bring our next presenter's presentation up momentarily. And then if we get short on time for questions, we'll ask folks to plug them into the chat box, and we can try and answer them that way. But hopefully we'll have a little bit of extra time. Our next presenter is Jake Breedlove. He is the Grant and Watershed Coordinator for the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. He is responsible for administering the water quality improvement grants, as well as coordinating with various watershed groups throughout Arizona to improve water quality. He's been with ABEC for 2 years. Jake, are you on the phone?
Yep. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just great.
All right, great.
Make sure our other presenters are muted, and we'll let you take it away.
All right. Well, once again, Kristen, thank you very much for putting on this this conference. It's a great way to get all these funding opportunities out there and make people aware of them. And kind of like with some of the other groups, I see some familiar names that may have attended some of our webinars recently for our program. And so some of this information might be a little repetitive, but we'll try and break it down and move along and try and stay on our time frame here. So who I am, my name is Jake Breedlove. As Kristen mentioned, I'm the Grant and Watershed Coordinator here at the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. And again, I'm responsible for administering our water quality improvement grant program. So kind of a quick general overview of what's going on right now with our grant program. We're currently in cycle 14. Our RFGA, our request for grant application, was released on July 1st of this year with $1.2 million of it in available funding. And then that's usually around our average amount of funding, and we'll kind of go into that. Some important dates that are coming up, and I'll touch base on these again towards the end, but our first date coming up are pre-proposals, which is a mandatory part of our application process, are due Friday, August 9th, and then our final applications being due September 20th. And then the funding for this grant cycle is only available for impaired waterways, and so we'll talk a little bit about what that actually means. So a little bit of background on our program. It's federally funded through the Environmental Protection Agency through the Clean Waters Act, Section 319. So in some other states, you may have heard the program referred to as the 319 program, kind of the same thing that we have here in Arizona. The funds are received by EPA, and then those funds are administered by ADEQ as a reimbursement-based grant program. And one of our caveats at this time, or requirements at this time, is that the funds are used to implement on-the-ground water quality improvements to reduce non-point source pollution. That on-the-ground piece is one of our major restrictions at this time, and the non-point source pollution aspect has always been a requirement of our type of funding. So to touch a little bit on non-point source pollution, for those that might not be aware of the difference between point source and non-point source pollution, point source pollution is the one that most people are aware of. This is typically a discharge directly into a waterway, so a pipe flowing directly into a waterway. Point source issues are permitted, they're regulated, and so there is a compliance aspect to those. However, non-point source pollution is all those other pollution sources. So when we have rainfall or snow melt across the land, and that carries pollutants into our waterways, those are non-point source pollution issues. Because those are not a regulated aspect, and it's much harder to point fingers at who's causing that pollution, non-point source pollution is one of the largest sources of water quality issues we face across the nation, and it's also a non-permitting and non-regulated aspect of it. And so to help reduce non-point source pollution, we use incentives such as our water quality improvement grant program. So some common non-point source issues we deal with here in Arizona deal with sediment, nutrients, that's going to be like nitrogen and phosphorus, pathogens such as E. coli, and then metals such as, say, copper. And then on the right-hand side, we list just some common sources of non-point source pollution that we deal with in Arizona. Recreation, agricultural practices, grazing, and as well as mining. And you see many of the pictures there represent some sources of non-point source pollution. So one of the questions most people are always concerned about is who can apply for these programs? And my answer is always pretty much anyone. Our eligible applicants are listed there and includes just about everybody that you can, whether it be private landowners, universities, environmental groups, schools and colleges, nonprofit organizations, just about anybody can apply for our grant program. Some of the general eligibility requirements for the Water Quality Improvement Grant is we have a greater focus than we have in the past on the on-the-ground implementation aspect of our program, ensuring that projects are putting on-the-ground projects in that are going to reduce non-point source pollution sources. In previous cycles, if you're aware of the program, we've been able to fund completely education and outreach programs. However, due to our restrictions on our funding, we still want to see that education and outreach component to an application, but it has to be tied to an implementation, so to an on-the-ground project being put in, and we'll kind of give some examples of those as we go. Our program is a reimbursement-based grant. It's 60-40. That 40% is non-federal match, and I'll take a moment and talk a little bit about what that means, what can that non-federal match consist of. And, of course, with any grants, eligibility, complying with the grant processes, meeting state and federal guidelines, as well as a SMART growth scorecard, which is a pretty easy information to pull up. And then in that yellow box on the bottom is one of our big caveats for our funds right now for our grant program is funding is only available for waterways designated as impaired by ADEQ. This hasn't always been a restriction of our funding. It's more of a recent one with our previous cycle as well as this cycle as that need for impairment, or I should say contributing to an impairment, making sure that to make that connection that the non-point source pollution coming off of your area, coming off of that property is contributing to an impairment, so making its way to that impairment. And so what does it mean to be impaired? We go off two lists that are developed by ADEQ. There's the 303D and the 305B list, and without going into great detail on those both of those lists can be are available via the AZDEQ website. Those lists are very long and very comprehensive, and so to make it easier for applicants to see very quickly whether the area they're looking to do a project is impaired, we have a GIS interactive map via our website as well. And the image there on the right is of that map. You just go to the azdeq.gov homepage, and on the right-hand side is a link called GIS eMaps. And from there, you can pull up a layer that shows all the impaired waters in Arizona, and kind of depend on how big it is on your screen on your end. You can kind of see the blue waterways, and then any of those areas that are red along those waterways are our impairments. And so you can zoom in on your area and see if that's if the area you're looking to do your project in is impaired. And so the other part of our grant, that 60-40, that 40% non-federal match component, that can be in-kind match as well as any type of cash funds as well. You can also leverage other state or foundation grants. An example would be funds from the Water Protection Fund could be utilized as part of that match component, also private grants. If you've received private funding for projects, those funds can be used as that 40% match as well as other things such as volunteer time, anyone donating their time or donating their services, or donating their equipment usage, any of those things can be used for that match component. We run into the challenge is that it is a 40% non-federal match. So when I say just about anyone can apply for our funds, that non-federal match tends to be a hiccup for federal agencies. We have worked with federal agencies such as the Forest Service in the past on projects, but it's a little more challenging for those groups to develop that 40% non-federal match component because they can't use any federal salaries towards that match piece. So it becomes a little more challenging for those groups, but it has been done. More information about the match component can be found in our RFGA, which is available on the ADEQ website. And kind of like Rodney mentioned with Water Protection Fund, we have that same caveat of the match can only begin to accrue after the grant has been awarded or fully executed. So until that final signatures are on the contract, none of the time or any of that can be used towards the match component. So before I talk a little bit about potential grant projects or examples, we'll talk a little bit about projects not eligible for funding. And so projects not eligible for funding include point source issues or water quantity focused projects. Our funding has to be used for non-point source, and the focus has to be on water quality rather than quantity. Projects designed to comply with a permit, and so if someone's looking to do a project to comply with their discharge permit or within a city, if the project they're looking to do is going to be used to comply with a stormwater permit, any activities that are tied to that permit or the permitting are identified as point source issues at that point, and so they wouldn't qualify for our funding. Projects consider day-to-day operations and maintenance, projects that address a symptom of pollution without addressing the source of pollution. An example of that might be where we're receiving a project that's looking to remove nutrients from a lake, such as dredging a lake, but it's not dealing with the actual inputs, what's causing those nutrients to continue to come into that lake. Without addressing the source of the pollution, we wouldn't address the symptoms beforehand. And so we would look for projects to address the inputs coming into that lake prior to addressing anything with dredging of the lake or removing the nutrients from the lake. Any projects that relieve enforcement or compliance, if someone's been ordered to do something to comply with their permit or with their activities, anything like that would be ineligible. Research-only projects, and then, of course, anything if we receive an incomplete application or an application after the deadline, any of those would be deemed ineligible for funding. So some potential projects. These are just some images that have taken from previous projects that kind of have that riparian restoration focus to them. And so that first series, stream bank contouring, there was high sediment inputs in that area. And in the upper picture, you can see a lot of that stream banks being washed away, and so they were able to contour the bank and revegetate the bank as well to kind of hold that soil back, but that's also going to develop into some nice riparian habitat as well. Pictures on the right, off riparian solar wells and fencing, and so this is actually a above and below example from a project. The upper picture has been fenced off from cattle, and solar wells and tanks have been placed on that landowner's property. And then the picture on the bottom is just to the right of the fence line, where the landowner hasn't done any activities. And so we can see the nice plush riparian area in the upper picture, and a lot of sources of E. coli could potentially come from there if the cattle are coming in there and we don't have that riparian buffer to kind of support that area and hold back that soil as well. Another example of projects that have been funded, this is a wetland restoration. projects, and so we can see kind of the before and after images there. And again, this is these riparian areas and this restoration is overall improving water quality as well as developing habitat for wildlife. And so while our focus is to improve water quality, there's obviously a lot of other benefits that can come from that, from doing those types of projects. And so these are just some examples of projects that have that riparian restoration aspect to them that are going to also benefit water quality, which again is our focus. And so a little bit about our current grant cycle. As I mentioned, on July 1st, we went out with our request for grant application, and our deadlines come up in about a month or so. We actually just finished our webinars this past week, but the full RFGA as well as all the necessary forms are all available on the ADEQ website. You can download the full RFGA there. All of our applications, our pre-proposal application and then our final application, are in Adobe format to help folks more easily be able to access those and download those. And then all our additional forms, our budget forms are all there, and all the forms necessary for applying for the program are going to be available there. Some of the deadlines to go along with our grant cycle that we're in right now, as I mentioned, our pre-proposal. Pre-proposal is a mandatory aspect of our project, and so that deadline's kind of coming up pretty quick. If you don't have a project in mind, it may be a little more difficult to try and develop out that pre-proposal prior to the deadline, but you can always give it a shot. So our first deadline coming up, that mandatory pre-proposal, is Friday, August 9th, by 3 p.m. This is a entirely electronic copy that has to be submitted, but it does have to include some attachments. You should have a draft budget as well as any images or maps that's going to help to identify the area and help to determine whether it's an eligible project or not. As far as the draft budget at that point, we're not looking for solid values for the different fields. It's mainly are all the necessary components of the project, are they identified in the budget to ensure that there's no surprises later on as to whether funding is going to be available for a project or not. And then, again, that's all submitted via online, and then feedback is given regarding the pre-proposals. And then applicants are able to develop their final application. And so the final applications for our program is Friday, September 20th, again by 3 p.m. And this is all a hard copy aspect to it. And all this information, again, is in the RFGA as well. But you're submitting a minimum one hard copy with original signature, with an additional five hard copies as well, and then an electronic version on CD, as well as any maps or appendices, letters of recommendation or letters of consent, any of that type of information would be submitted in that as appendices as well, and those would be delivered to our Phoenix office by the deadline listed there. And lastly, I'm going to talk just a little bit about the future of our water quality improvement grant program. Because the funds that we receive are from EPA, and so there's greater focus in, by EPA to that implementation or putting on the ground projects in. There's also a greater emphasis on the development of watershed implementation plans. These are plans that have been developed by watershed partners to identify sources of non-point source pollution and also identify projects that best management practices or projects that are going to reduce that that those sources of pollution. And so kind of the future of our grant program is we're looking to do a greater collaboration internally with our TMDL unit, which is they do investigations into identifying sources of pollution and how much, and then assigning values to those. But working with our TMDL unit, as well as watershed partners, to develop additional watershed implementation plans. And then using those implementation plans as well as the ones we have to be our highest priority areas for projects. And so if you're interested in learning more about development of those watershed implementation plans outside of this grant process, I would encourage you to contact me as well. The best way to learn about when our grants are coming out, typically we do these on an annual basis, but our timelines have fairly changed just depending on our available funding. We have this grant cycle that'll be deadline is in September, and we're already talking about moving towards a spring grant cycle as well, and kind of getting on that as our annual go-around for our grant cycles. And so the best way to find out once these become available, as well as some other funding sources that I try and pass along, is by signing up for our email list. That can be done through the ADEQ website. Right up at the top, there's a button or that says subscribe, and then you can put your email address in and check mark Water Quality Improvement Grant Program. And anytime I receive any information about funding opportunities or information of interest, as well as our grant program, I try and send those out to folks, and that's the quickest way to learn when our grant cycle or when our grant program becomes available. I went a little quick there, but hopefully kind of caught back up on time a little bit. But there's my contact information as well. You may have noticed on the very first slide it said Samuel Jake Breedlove. That's where the S in my email comes from. Samuel's my first name, but I go by Jake to confuse everybody. My email and phone number are listed there, as well as visiting the ADEQ website will get you additional information. So at that point, that's it for me, and I'll turn it back over to Kristen.
Great. Thank you so much, Jake. That was another very helpful and thorough presentation. So we are at 1:30, and I'm not sure if our presenters have time to take questions, if there are any. So let me see. Again, a reminder, if you have questions, you can ask them by pressing star 1 on your phone. And we really would be grateful if you would take the time to fill out the survey, the evaluation survey, so that we can improve this webinar series and ensure that it's relevant to your needs. So let's see if we have any questions. And as we are waiting for that, and we'll try and wrap up here no later than 1:40, or rather 12:40 Arizona time, but I did want to ask Rodney if his program funds monitoring over the long term. So if there's any, or I guess if there's a component, I know that monitoring was one of the criteria or the components of what a project had to have, but I wonder if any of the funds that are applied for can cover that.
We don't fund just strictly monitoring, so we do look for that as a component of a capital project. So if you're doing anything on the ground, you know, we want to see how you are evaluating whether or not you're realizing the benefits. Under our research category, we don't just fund strict data collection or monitoring. It has to be associated with a specific hypothesis that you're testing. So,
if it's part of implementation or the research proposal, it can be a component of this report?
Correct. We just wouldn't be able to fund ongoing monitoring of an existing project. So if you just really wanted to go out and continue doing monitoring, just normal monitoring that we would do, we would not be able to fund that. But like, if it's part of a project that we're funding, yes. If it's obviously, if you're doing a research project, there's going to be some kind of sampling monitoring going on. But just district.
And okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I guess the follow-up question I had was that you said that sort of habitat was a secondary priority. Is there any increased priority if it's critical habitat for endangered species?
Could you say that again? I'm sorry.
I was just wondering if the project has a restoration component that creates critical habitat for endangered species, if that increases the priority of a project.
Basically, what we do is we add that into the evaluation comments. So each of those areas in our evaluation identify those priorities. So it really depends on the overall project itself. So yes, it is a consideration.
Okay. It looks like we have a written question for Jake about whether projects that are outside of the waterways that you identified, such as Willow Creek, can be considered.
In the RFGA, we talk about what our highest priority areas are and then our secondary priority areas are, and then everything outside of that, as long as it's contributing to an impairment, that would be eligible. And so our highest priority areas are where we have those watershed implementation plans that I mentioned at the end. Those are Oak Creek near the Sedona area, Upper Granite Creek in the Prescott area, and then the San Francisco Blue Rivers near the Clifton area. Those are our highest priority areas. That just means that if it's a project in one of those plans, it receives additional bonus points. And then our secondary targeted areas include the Tonneau and Christopher Creeks east of Payson, as well as the headwaters of the Little Colorado River. And so those receive bonus points as well. Anywhere in the state where, like I said, it's contributing to an impairment, and it's, of course, it's a non-point source contribution to an impairment, would be eligible for funding.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have one question for Marty. Do you have a specific definition for what is urban for the Urban Wildlife Program?
Yes. That is, I don't have it with me. We do have that identified on our website, all
okay.
The subcategories. Within the funding window, it gives the description of what that entails for each of them, and then the goals, objectives, or priorities listed below of what we're looking for on projects.
Okay. And for the environmental education and outdoor education programs, are there age restrictions, or does it apply to elementary, high school, or other?
No, we go elementary through university level.
We have
projects from elementary schools, from community colleges. It doesn't matter. No age restrictions.
So programs such as those that conservation corps often cover in the way of on-the-ground implementation and workforce training, would that qualify?
Say that again. I didn't catch.
Would programs such as those that conservation corps tend to encourage in terms of workforce training and environmental education, restoration, trail maintenance, and so forth, would those qualify under one of those categories of programs that you offer?
Probably not. I don't, maybe under urban wildlife, if there's a way to write it up in such a way where it also focuses on some of the goals, objectives that we're looking for.
Okay.
But not within the EE, OE, or schoolyard.
Okay. Okay, good to know. That's it from me, and I'm not seeing any questions from our participants. So I think we can wrap it up. Thanks again. And everyone who's called in or called in a little bit later or in the middle of the webinar, please know that you can access a recording as well as the PowerPoint on our website, tamariscoalition.org, in about a week. And if you have questions, feel free to contact me and I can direct you to our presenters. And remember that Rodney mentioned with the Arizona Water Protection Fund, you can submit your early versions of your grant for review to get his feedback on those. And thank you so much to our presenters. We can conclude the webinar unless you have anything to add.
Thank you, everyone.
Yep, thanks, Kristen.
Okay, thank you so much. And have a great rest of your Thursday, everyone. Take care.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.